This is Audible.
Poison at Pemberton Hall, The First Mystery for Vita Carew by Fran Smith. Read by Fran Smith. Copyright 2020 by Fran Smith. All rights reserved. Chapter 1. Cambridge, 1903. The woman was in a hurry, pausing at a corner to study a piece of paper. She turned into a side street before reaching a shadowy doorway. There was mud on the cobbles, and a thin rain made them shine under the flickering gas lamps. She knocked, stepping into the entrance to shelter from the rain, and glancing up and down the street as she waited. A broad, dour-faced woman servant with sleeves rolled back over large forearms opened the door and led her wordlessly down a gloomy passage into the room at the end. A raised chair stood at the centre. Trays of instruments were laid out in rows on cloth-covered tables. The man neither stood nor turned to look at her, but continued stirring something in a glass vial, holding it to the light. He wore a stained white jacket. "You understand my terms?" "Yes." The visitor reached into her handbag and took several coins from her purse. She held them out, but he gestured, with a tilt of the head, that she should lay them on a shelf near the door. "Sit in the chair," he said. Shuddering, the woman made no move. "It must not be pressed or tapped, I beg you. It is so terribly painful." She held her cheek with a gloved hand. "It must be lanced and the rest of the tooth removed. There is a risk of poisoning the blood otherwise." She hesitated still. The dentist sighed and continued his stirring. "If it is not treated, it will hurt you more. You have tried the medicine the other dentist gave you?" "For almost 2 weeks. It brought no relief. My whole face is affected. I can barely speak." It was true. She laboured the words from her mouth between clenched teeth. The dentist looked over at her for the first time as if making an assessment. He held out the vial of medicine he had prepared. "Take this now. It is unusually strong. Only my customary pharmacist will make it up. It exceeds the dosage that is usually permitted." The woman clutched her handbag to her chest. "Will this take away the pain?" "It will dull the pain while I extract the remaining parts of the tooth." She took the vial and held it briefly to her nose. "And once the tooth is gone?" "That depends on what I find. This medicine will help. You can take some with you and use it as needed." "I must not be drowsy. I have responsibilities. I care for children." "Sit in the chair and allow me to examine the tooth." Grimacing, the woman swallowed the contents of the glass vial, removed her bonnet, and moved to the chair. "You will not tap it." "I will do what I need to do." The dentist stood, calling out of the door, "Mrs. Griffiths, I need you to hold." The neighbours were used to the terrible cries that followed. Chapter 2. The city of Cambridge boasted several long-established pharmacies, their interiors shining with polished brass, their walls lined with drawers, labelled in lavishly curlicued copperplate writing, tincture of benzoin, camphor, copper sulphate. In these establishments, customers sat in comfortable chairs whilst the pharmacist and his assistants hurried to fetch, crush, blend, and package the many medicines and appliances on offer. Ledgers recorded every transaction. Repeat prescriptions were accurately made up. Doctors' instructions carefully followed. Money was hardly mentioned. It was taken by a cashier at a desk in the corner as if it were an afterthought. But this particular chemist had no friendly clerk at a desk near the door, nor were there helpers in white coats climbing ladders to pull exotic herbs and medicaments from high drawers. It did have two large bottles of blue water in the window, but they were dusty, and the curtain behind them had been eaten by moths. The pharmacist, a large man with a boxer's flattened nose and hair oiled into a centre parting, looked more as if he would wrestle customers than serve them politely. But his shop still did steady business. There were no chairs. Nobody cared to dally in the dim interior. Their visits were generally as short as they could make them. Peter found this place after a recommendation. She needed chemicals in order to carry out the experiments suggested in her chemistry textbook, but many of the smarter pharmacists showed themselves oddly unwilling to sell them to her. It had never occurred to Vita that anyone might object to a young woman's scholarly purchase of, say, hydrochloric acid or formaldehyde. What business was it of theirs if she carried out experiments in her bedroom? But the gentlemanly pharmacists looked uncomfortable when she asked for them, and one even asked her to return with a letter of permission. Aunt Louisa tolerated Vita's experiments and her studies in general, although she occasionally objected to loud explosions or pungent odours. But Vita had no wish to test matters to the limit by bothering her with requests for letters. When Mr. Gadd's shop was recommended as a cheap and unquestioning source of chemicals favoured by many students, she went along the next day for some prussic acid and sal volatile. The shop, though poorly lit and dusty, had several shelves displaying test tubes, vials, and a whole range of glass and rubber experimental equipment, which immediately caught Vita's eye. She was inspecting them when the door opened and another customer stepped in. The other customer, a thin woman in a brown coat, entered briskly. Pulling her purse from her handbag, she walked straight to the counter and laid her coins in front of the owner without speaking. Equally silent, he glanced at the money, bent slightly to a shelf at knee height behind the counter, and produced a stoppered blue bottle, which looked small in his broad-knuckled fist. He set it on the counter between them. "I'll take two bottles this time, please," a customer said. The pharmacist was slow to react, but a shadow darkened his expression. He nodded towards the small pile of coins between them. "That pays for one bottle," he told her. Neither looked up. A cart clattered by outside, iron wheel rims grating the cobbles. "Perhaps you will allow me the second on credit," she suggested. The pharmacist drummed heavy fingers briefly on the wooden surface. "No credit. My customers sometimes forget to pay their debts." His hand fell back onto the small bottle, and he began to remove it. "No, I will take that one, if that is all you will allow." She tried once again. "I shall not be able to come next week. They are entertaining at the big house." "Which big house is that?" She seemed unsettled by this sudden interest, hesitating before answering. "Pemberton Hall."
"Pemberton Hall."
"I know a rhyme about Pemberton Hall," Gad said.
"Rule at Pemberton, warm and well fed. Serve at Pemberton, early dead."
He grinned at his customer's discomfort. "I have business with one of the servants there, Mr. Billings. You know him?"
"Billings, yes, of course. He is valet to his lordship," she said. There was a slight suggestion of distaste in her tone.
"Good customer of mine is Mr. Billings," said the pharmacist. "He was here only yesterday." Gad leaned over the counter towards her, speaking confidentially. "You can take the second bottle, miss, if you promise to send the balance of the money with Mr. Billings. He comes every Thursday."
He placed a second bottle beside the first, and slid both towards her with one hand, shoveling the coins into the till drawer with the other. By the time he looked up, both bottles were gone, and the door was already closing. Vita had observed this odd conversation from a corner. The pharmacist had clearly forgotten she was there, and registered surprise and possibly resentment when he saw her, but was happy enough to sell her a glass retort and the chemicals she wanted. The price was lower than she had expected. No information was requested. No questions were asked. Vita stepped back out into the chilly afternoon with the cheerful feeling of having overcome at least one small obstacle to her scientific studies, even if the details of Gad's shop lingered uncomfortably in her memory.
Chapter 3. Now, Vita, I thought we agreed. No textbooks at the breakfast table. The breakfast room at 144 Eden Street was filled with soft winter sunshine. It lit the marmalade and made the silver teapot shine. Vita's Aunt Louisa, in her working-day outfit of frilled white blouse and dark skirt, poured tea and handed a cup to her niece, adding, "How's your German, dear? Didn't you have a Swiss governess at one time?" The question caught Vita by surprise. "Yes, Fräulein Weber. But my German is rusty and limited, I'm afraid." She closed her book, Studies in Fossil Botany, and looked over at her aunt. Louisa flourished the thickly embossed invitation she had just pulled from its envelope. "We are invited to Pemberton Hall. A dinner and gala concert. Felicity Pemberton is a dear friend. Her son Alexander is my godson. He was a musical scholar here in Cambridge and visited often. A very talented and agreeable young man. He will be performing with Carlotta von Diepenthal. Have you heard the name? She has performed all over Europe. It should be quite spectacular." She glanced back at the letter accompanying the invitation. "Many of the guests will be German. Do you own a formal gown?" "I've worn my white dress to parties occasionally," Vita said, but she sounded doubtful. "You have no evening gown? I never had need of one. There were no parties to go to." "Nonsense, is that what my brother told you?" "There were several rather grand events in the season when we were growing up in Devon. I have fond memories of dancing until dawn at the Hunt Ball, at Waveney House in particular." Aunt Louisa looked into the distance with a happy expression. "Some of the young men were fine dancers in those days. But that is a long time ago and beside the point. At 18, every young woman should own at least one presentable evening gown, one that will serve with a few adaptations in every eventuality. Otherwise, one must borrow an outfit, which is rarely satisfactory, or even refuse the grander kind of invitation, and where will that lead?" "To a quiet life, without tiresome social occasions?" Vita suggested mildly, buttering her toast. The older lady frowned. She wasn't to be thwarted. "I shall take you to Miss Pushkin. She is my own dressmaker and very reliable." "Oh, but Aunt, I will call there at 11. And your spectacles, Vita. They are lopsided." Aunt Louisa left, heading for her studio. Vita removed her spectacles and held them up to see where they were bent. The marmalade continued to glow golden in the sunlight. "Oh dear," she said to the empty room. It was her first winter in Cambridge. She missed her father and the familiar routine of his Devon parish. An extravagant society occasion with Germans to speak to, and a new gown. The thought of it made her want to hide under the table. Chapter 4. Miss Pushkin's place of business was a colourful basement, shimmering with rich fabric and beautiful dresses displayed on rows of headless wooden mannequins. The view from the sunken window was of railings, passing boots, and the hems of coats as they swept by at eye level. Vita studied them wistfully, looking up from the soft velvet sofa provided for clients. "You see, I was hoping to start a program of reading. I am so very far behind," she explained to her aunt. Louisa, perfectly at home in the little basement she knew so well, was browsing bolts of fabric on a broad cutting table across the room, feeling the quality and pulling lengths out to match colours with a painter's eye. "Pemberton has a wonderfully well-stocked library. You will be perfectly free to use that, dear. I've known Alexander since he was born. He first met Carlotta at my house. You simply must attend. Besides, they would be so grateful if you could help translate for the German guests. Really, it is a cry from the heart from my oldest friend. Her circumstances are difficult. It would be cruel to refuse." Miss Pushkin entered from her sewing room, brisk and elegant in grey silk. "Miss Pushkin, my niece Vita needs an evening dress suitable for a gala occasion. It will be her first." Unsmiling, the dressmaker turned her professional gaze to Vita. "Stand, please," she said. Vita stood. There then followed a long pause, while both ladies looked the girl up and down, assessing dressmaking possibilities. They circled her silently. Heifers must feel this way at a cattle market, Vita thought, but did her best not to waver. "The lighter blue silk, I think," Miss Pushkin finally declared. "Perfect," Aunt Louisa agreed. She and the dressmaker began to delve into the pattern books on the table, turning the pages this way and that, their heads together. Necklines and trims were discussed, buttons were chosen, fittings agreed. Vita was consulted, but only briefly. Mostly she just sat and envied the passers-by, whose boots she could see striding the pavement outside. Chapter 5. On the train, her aunt settled herself into her seat. Trunks and hat boxes had been stowed by the porter. Gentlemen waiting on Cambridge Station pressed their hats to their heads with gloved hands in the bitter wind. Trees along the line swayed and tossed against a gloomy grey sky. "Now, Vita, every guest should arrive at least a little prepared." Vita had naturally brought a textbook with her, but she set it unopened on the seat beside her. Felicity McMartin, we grew up as neighbours in Devon, married Richard Pemberton almost 20 years ago. Dickie was a younger brother. His older brother, Roland, was to inherit the title and Pemberton Hall, but Roland died in India quite suddenly, so against expectations, Dickie inherited. They watched the gentle hills south of Cambridge roll by the window for a moment. Felicity and Dickie began their married life in a perfectly ordinary house. Dickie is a military man, a long tradition in the family. Alexander was born there. But once Dickie inherited the title, there was no question of staying. They had to move to Pemberton Hall. I won't bother to describe the place, you will see it for yourself. It was once extremely grand, but when they took possession, it had fallen into a state of sorry disrepair. The expense of maintaining a great house and its staff is immense, as you can imagine. They have had to sell a great deal of land, furniture and silverware to cover debts and expenses. Her aunt paused as they came into one of the small stations on the branch line, and two ladies carrying large baskets clambered aboard further down the platform. Felicity had a small inheritance of her own. That, and the fact that Dickie became a horse breeder of some reputation, kept them afloat. But then there was his accident. "Tickets, please, ladies." A uniformed ticket inspector appeared, smiling, and punched their tickets with the flourish of a man enjoying his work. It was 2 years ago now. He was thrown from his horse and severely damaged his back. "How dreadful," Vita said. It was. He was bedridden for many months, and still suffers from a partial paralysis. "Poor Dickie, he is a countryman at heart, loved the outdoors, always rode and spent his days among horses or on the land. Now all he can do is sit in a chair. It has been terribly difficult for everyone, but for Felicity in particular. Once the charitable visits to the sick man were all completed, very few people continued to call. Dickie locked himself away." Vita was familiar with the isolation of a home where an invalid must be the focus of all attention. Her aunt brightened a little. "I have visited at least twice a year since, and I am happy to say that little by little Dickie has resumed his bloodstock interests. He has some excellent brood mares, I'm told, and high hopes of one of their recent foals. Work to restore the house continues. It's never ending. In such a place there is always a leaking roof or rotting timber somewhere, and every inspection finds something worse hidden underneath. Some people think Pemberton is prone to bad luck and accidents. We were once at dinner when a chandelier crashed to the floor in the room next door. The sound was so dramatic that we thought the whole wing had fallen down. But all we found when we dared to look was an empty room entirely coated in broken crystal and a table-sized hole in the ceiling. It was a miracle no one was killed. Louisa sighed and smiled at her niece. So, Vita, if ever you had fanciful ideas about the grandeur of living in a stately country house, a few days at Pemberton Hall will probably cure you of them. It can be a gloomy old place, but everyone agrees on one thing. The food is excellent. They have rather a famous French chef. Before Dickie's accident, Monsieur Picard's reputation alone used to bring eager guests from far and wide, royalty included. The Hall was famous for its spectacular dinners. They have hardly entertained at all recently, so perhaps this event marks a sort of re-entry into society for them. Let us hope so. By now they were slowing, and their station, Pemberton Mount Ferris, was in sight. Felicity and the children will welcome you, but Dickie can be brusque. He is in constant pain and tires easily. On social occasions, he comes and goes as he pleases. He may appear at dinner, or his place may stand empty, one can never tell. The unwritten rule is to carry on without comment. You will like the children. Mary Ann loves company, and William is a serious little boy. Last time I saw him, his main interest was trains. Wear your bed socks and an extra vest in bed, and if there are no spare blankets, ask for some. The hall is notoriously cold. And thank you for coming. I can tell you nothing about the German guests, except that they do not seem to speak any English. So if you are the main translator, you are likely to be kept busy. She looked out of the window. And here we are. They are sending the cart with a footman, so we needn't worry about our bags. The train pulled into the station, and through the steam of the engine, they saw a tall, uniformed man step forward. "Mrs. Brocklehurst, welcome back," he said, smiling in greeting and stepping forward to hold a large umbrella over the ladies' heads. "And this must be Miss Carew." "Good morning, Tom," said Louisa. "My niece's trunk is near mine, and there are two blue hat boxes." "This way, ladies," Tom said, leading them to a waiting pony and trap. He helped them onto the seat and pulled the heavy cover over their knees before turning back for their bags. Curtains of rain were now falling from low black clouds. The horses splashed arcs of mud as they approached Pemberton. The downpour drenched the branches of the ancient chestnut trees along the drive, and a sharp wind shook the sculpted hedges of the formal garden. Louisa pulled a paper from her handbag and handed it to her niece. "Before I forget, Vita, here is something I have devised to keep you entertained," she said. They left the avenue of trees and drew towards the great house. Vita was puzzled and read the paper curiously. "Is it a sort of quest or treasure hunt?" "It is a list of a few of the paintings in the hall. You are to find them and be prepared to discuss their merits. I thought you would like something to keep your mind active and to practice your powers of analysis. I promised your father that I would add to your education. This will sharpen your knowledge of the history of art." Her aunt was looking pleased with herself. "I thought you might need some occasional respite from translating. It will give you an excuse to explore the hall and something to occupy your mind." Vita felt her mind was perfectly well occupied already with trying to conquer the basics of physics and chemistry, but she liked the idea of a reason to venture about the great house on her own. "Thank you, Aunt," she said. You had time only to read the first item, the Admiral, before the carriage arrived outside the grand stone staircase sweeping up to the porticoed entrance of Pemberton Hall. As the guests arrived that morning, a tour of inspection was underway in the bustling basement kitchens of Pemberton Hall. Monsieur Picard, the chef, Mr. Swain, the butler, and Mrs. Dobbs, head cook, were making their morning rounds. All three were senior members of the household with strong views, but here in the kitchen nobody crossed Emile Picard, a distinguished veteran. He had run kitchens far grander than Pemberton Hall's, but these days he chose a quieter life. Older now, his moods could be unpredictable, but his food was reliably magnificent. Any tension over the demands being placed on the kitchen by a gala dinner with many guests showed only in a general briskness, and cook's quick steps as she led the two men from one room to another. She was a short, energetic woman, round and rosy-cheeked.
"I had to put the quail in the scullery. They're hanging over the big sinks, Mr. Picard. There are too many for the game room. We shall have our work cut out just dressing them all in time. There's pheasant and duck too, but they're in the usual place, and most of them's already done. I shall set about the consommé soon. Did you want your usual consommé? It just says consommé on my list."
"Volée. It says consommé de volée, does it not?" said Monsieur Picard. Both peered at the handwritten menu he held, he squinting at arm's length.
"Oh yes, volailles."
Cook, though expert at reading menu French, pronounced the words in an insistently English way.
"Just chicken, or were you wanting turkey or guinea fowl in it as well?"
No, chicken only."
"Right you are. Now those French oysters, they are in the ice rooms, out by the back door. I shall need a couple of your lads to help with opening the shells, Mr. Swain."
"I can spare Alfred and Tommy, but I'll need them back by 5 to serve at table."
"They shall have to work fast, then. Mussels and razor clams, Mr. Picard, just a quick scolding?"
"Yes, I shall prepare the sauces myself. They must be presented on the tall..." Monsieur had forgotten the word. He waved his hands. "Those tall things with many levels."
"The tiered stands, yes, we know that, Mr. Picard. The venison and lamb you've already seen. The peaches, pineapples and asparagus are in the cold store with the salads. The ice creams are made and in the ice boxes. You'll make the jellies, I think?"
"Oui."
"The other pastries also, and the wines, Monsieur Swain?"
"All present and correct," the butler told him.
"Chambertin, 1875. Moët Chandon, 1884. Chateau Latour, 1875. And his lordship's choice of port and brandy."
The three paused and slowed a little. They stood now at one end of a scrubbed wooden table, stretching the long length of the great house's vaulted-ceilinged kitchen. On shelves around the walls, copper pans in serried rows glowed in the light of lamps overhead. At one end, the black range with 5 large ovens and spits large enough to roast a whole pig seemed still, but the occasional glimpse of a glowing ember and the smell of roasting meat that filled the kitchen showed the fire was alive within and the meal underway.
"Well," said Swain, "we seem to be ahead of ourselves."
"Don't say that, Mr. Swain, you'll tempt fate. It's the ice that worries me, what with all this new shellfish from France. Ice isn't easy to come by. It doesn't grow on trees, you know."
"Can more be found?" Swain asked, fighting the temptation to remind cook that ice did grow on trees now and then.
"Not easily. We'd have to send to town for it. There may be enough."
"And the pastry table is mine from noon, yes?" asked Monsieur Picard.
"We shall clear the far end for your pastry work as usual, but we shall need to be working at this end. There's still game to be dressed and butchery to be done, so you know."
"Of course," said the chef, and placing the menu back in his pocket, he turned and walked away. Cook watched him go before turning back to Swain.
Chapter 6. He upset Cora and Annie again today. Called them clumsy and swore at them in French, poor girls.
"Do they know French?" asked Swain.
"Well, no, but it sounded rude, whatever he said. He is very hard on my kitchen maids lately, Mr. Swain. Can you have a word with him? I do not want them in floods of tears and running off to their rooms. I've quite enough to do without that sort of shenanigans."
Swain looked up the empty corridor in the direction taken by the chef. "He is not quite himself, I grant you.
There has been a little difficulty, he said.
Difficulty?
Mrs. Dobbs was suddenly alert.
What sort of difficulty?
Both looked up as the figure of Billings, the valet, emerged from a storeroom and moved swiftly to the back stairs leading up to the master's private quarters, stairs that only he was permitted to use.
I can't say I like the way that man comes and goes as he pleases, Mr. Swain. He's forever in and out of the kitchen making demands. I do not take orders from Mr. Johnny-come-lately Billings, nor do any of my kitchen maids. It's bad enough with that fussy Madam Miss Hartley and her finicky likes and dislikes.
Swain's expression was pained.
But you were saying something about Mr. Picard, a difficulty, you said.
Yes, a personal matter, said Swain, clearly weighing up whether to tell the cook more.
Mrs. Dobbs, reading his expression, looked piercingly up at the butler, who was taller by at least 18 inches.
Swain took the plunge. There is a disagreement between Monsieur Picard and Miss Hartley, he told her.
What sort of disagreement?
He has confided in me man to man. I do not want to betray his confidence, but he permitted me to share the information at my discretion.
Yes.
Miss Hartley has made a sudden and unwarranted declaration to Mr. Picard. A declaration of love. Swain delivered this nugget in the calmest manner, but its effect was to make Mrs. Dobbs rock back on her heels and grab for a side table to steady herself.
She never did.
He told me himself. The man was overwrought. She will not leave him alone. She puts notes under his door. She writes him poetry. She hides in corridors and accosts him with gifts. It is quite excessive. He assured me that he has done no more to encourage her than to express an interest in opera. He is fond of it, and happened to mention the fact in a brief conversation. Miss Hartley says he has lit the fire of love in her heart. Those were her words. Monsieur Picard meant no such thing, and now he cannot shake her off. He has been direct. He has told her frankly and plainly that he wants no more of it, but she will not desist. He believes it is a kind of madness, an amour fou, he called it.
Oh my, said cook, her hand pressed to her mouth in shock. But are you certain Mr. Picard has not played on her feelings?
I have only his word, but I believe him. He was genuinely distressed. Everything he does to discourage her only makes her more insistent, he says. It has been going on for several months. I tell you this now because I would not wish any short-tempered behaviour on Mr. Picard's part to disrupt the kitchen at a time like this. I hope we can keep this matter to ourselves.
I shall not tell a soul. I can't bother myself with love at a time like this. What about this shellfish? The first I heard of all this shellfish was Thursday. Whatever gave Mr. Picard the idea?
I believe someone overheard Miss Carlotta say that oysters were her particular favourite.
Someone?
Myself, as it happens. I mentioned it to Master Alexander, and he insisted they were added to the menu. There was a short pause during which Mrs. Dobbs glanced sternly upward at the butler.
I see, she said, with a grim expression. Ah, well, French oysters it is. Rather her than me.
Perhaps you would prefer a shepherd's pie, such as the one that Annie has cooked for us, Swain suggested, indicating that they should follow the chef. Upon my word, I would, she said. And they moved smartly off in the direction of the servants' dining room.
Chapter 7. Vita and her aunt were soon beside a fire, roaring in the largest fireplace Vita had ever seen.
I can hardly tell you how relieved we are that you could come, Lady Felicity said to Vita. I do not know how I should have managed. Miss von Diepenthal has brought her two aunts and their doctor,
a very strange little man with her. With our own family, guests from the university, and a few neighbours, we are a party of 32 for the concert and dinner. A large party by our recent standards. I expect your aunt told you my husband has been unwell. We haven't entertained on this scale for several years. I'm quite out of the habit. Carlotta and the German doctor speak a little English, but the aunts do not have a single word. Without you, it would have been nothing but nodding and pointing. Can you imagine? Carlotta always travels with her aunts, apparently, and the doctor was thought a necessity as they were travelling abroad. I suppose English doctors weren't to be trusted. She is making a tour of the country giving performances. Well, I should say she and Alexander together are making a tour. They frequently perform together and have a most enthusiastic following, I'm told, though the world of music is a mystery to me. Alexander, as you know, Louisa, certainly did not inherit any musical ability from my side of the family. How is he enjoying this success? He seems extremely well. His health is good. But he is also very preoccupied. They travel a great deal, and there seem to be endless plans and arrangements to be made. Strictly between us, I believe he might be going to propose to Miss Diepenthal. Please say nothing to anyone yet, but it seems a possibility. An engagement, Louisa said. He has said nothing formally as yet. I tell you this in confidence. We knew that he was extremely fond of Lotte, of course. Lady Pemberton looked into the fire for a moment. He can hardly bear her to be out of the room. Follows her like a puppy. Would you welcome such an engagement? Louisa asked her friend. There was a moment of hesitation. Vita suddenly felt that the ladies might prefer to speak without her presence. I wonder if I might visit the library before luncheon, she asked. If there is a German dictionary, it might help to look at it before I meet the German ladies. What a very thoughtful idea, said Lady Pemberton, and looking relieved, she pulled a lever beside the mantelpiece to summon the butler. Now, Vita, about your room. The German aunts have been very particular about where they will sleep. The housekeeper has had to make several rearrangements. She has put you in the yellow bedroom, at a little distance from the others. We don't use it very often. The bed is rather extraordinary. I hope you will be comfortable. Chapter 8. Swain, a stately presence in his tail-coated livery, led Vita down the stairs, across a marble-floored hall, and along a broad passageway, before throwing open a pair of double doors. The library was huge. Bookshelves ran from floor to ceiling, with ladders on brass rails to reach the highest shelves. It was also distinctly chilly. The coals in the grand fireplace were unlit, and there was a touch of damp in the air. At one end, a grand piano looked small among several large desks and sofas. "I'll send someone to light the fire, miss," Swain told her. "You are embarking on a course of study, I understand. May I ask which subject is of particular interest? I am familiar with the shelving arrangement here. Perhaps I can assist." Vita, slightly overpowered by the grandeur of the library and of the butler, most of her reading having been done in the public lending library or her own bedroom so far, was touched by Swain's thoughtful offer. "I am particularly interested in the sciences," she told him. "But if there are any German books, it would be helpful to glance at them too. My German might be a little rusty, and I am to translate." Swain led Vita to a small alcove on one side. "The family's collection of volumes on horse breeding is considered very thorough, I believe. There are also one or two books on equine anatomy and medicine, some quite rare. Biology as a science on its own may only be represented by studies of the flora and fauna of this area. Would they be of any use? As to German books..." Swain moved to another part of the library and indicated a small collection of books in several languages. You might find something here. I shall enjoy the search, Vita said. Then you only need a little warmth. I'll send a maid to light the fire directly. This seemed a great extravagance to Vita, brought up in a vicarage where economy was the first priority. But it didn't feel polite to resist Swain's generous offer. Thank you, was all she said. It's good to see the library in use, miss, he replied. Normally it has few visitors. Only Miss Hartley, the children's governess. You may meet her, but she reads only from the literature shelves over on the other side. Poetry, I believe, is her chief interest. She will not interrupt you. Chapter 9. Pemberton Hall's famous round tower was briefly bathed by a pale sun. Its butter-coloured stonework glowed. The two ladies at the drawing-room window were watching younger people strolling along the garden walk below. A couple and a younger girl taking advantage of a brief respite in the weather. The pair were in close conversation, absorbed and moving slowly. The girl ran and darted around them, dashing ahead, looping back, walking backwards to tell them something, then running forward again. Around them the sky softened into chalky smears of cloud, underlit with lavender. Mary Ann is like a puppy, her mother said. She adores Lottie. She follows them wherever they go. She wants her hair like Lottie's, her dress like Lottie's, Lottie this, Lottie that. I suppose she has lacked an older sister growing up. I had never considered it before. Chaperoning suits her. And what do you make of Lottie? Lady Pemberton turned and walked back to the fire. I have never in all my life seen a young man so entirely smitten. My son can hardly bear to be apart from her. If she so much as leaves a room, he pines until she returns. It seems excessive to me, but perhaps a mother is not the best judge. Her family has great wealth and position, though it is a good match in one way. But we shall see so little of Alexander once they marry. He already spends a great deal of time travelling. She stopped speaking and glanced suddenly over at her friend. Vita looks well. Is she staying with you for long? I hope so. My brother takes his daughter too much for granted. She helped him in the parish and acts as his secretary in his natural history work. I suspect he has neglected her education because he finds her so useful. She was a long time nursing her poor mother, as I recall. Yes, she was a great comfort, but it has cost her several years of her youth, and she has been far too much alone. My brother did not think to include her in even the limited social life around them in Devon. I hope a stay in Cambridge will bring her out into the world a little. Lady Felicity touched her friend's arm. It will, Louisa, I'm sure. It's such a pleasure to have you to talk to, my dear. Can you spare the time from your college portrait commissions? On that subject, I have a suggestion, Louisa said. Why don't I make a little watercolour portrait of Alexander and Carlotta? Something quite modern and informal. It will capture the moment far better than a photograph. You know how stiff portrait photographs can be. A portrait by you is always a delightful idea. Lottie's image is everywhere, but I shall have no portrait of Alexander if he marries and moves away. Then I shall suggest the idea to Alexander as soon as I see him. You haven't mentioned Dicky. How is his health recently? He seems well enough. I see so little of him. You do not spend time together? He has a new valet, Billings. Billings was his old army batman. They served together. Dicky employed him a few months ago without consulting me. He has been very good for Dicky in many ways. He has instituted a daily routine and regular exercise and treatments. Dr. Mills advises and Billings makes sure that every recommendation is followed to the letter.
There is the possibility of real progress, apparently. With perseverance, Dickie might even be able to walk independently again. All that sounds highly beneficial.
It is, except I, as his wife, have no part to play. Billings rules over every detail of Dickie's existence. He has turned Dickie's dressing room into a sick room, which I am hardly permitted to enter. When I do see my husband, Billings is always there in the background. He lurks. He listens. Nothing must disrupt the patient's routine. The other staff dislike him. He is high-handed and unpleasant to the maids, but Dickie will not hear a word against him.
Does this concern you, Felicity?
Felicity shrugged.
Dickie's health is improving. He is stronger and complains less of pain. He sleeps well. I must be grateful for that.
And how will Dickie react to the engagement, if it is put to him?
I really can't say. He seems so remote from everyday life. He and Billings are in a separate world. I am not needed.
I envy you your art, Louisa. It must be a fine thing to have your own occupation, your own gift.
But you paint well yourself, Felicity. I remember carrying easels to the cliffs to make seascapes in our girlhood. Do you have time nowadays?
The lady of the house waved a hand, taking in high windows, ancient portraits, chandeliers, and rugs on a marble floor stretching far into the distance. This house leaves little time for painting. Besides, I always prefer to walk in the fresh air to an afternoon in the studio, which is why my paintings are in the attic and yours hang in colleges and galleries. Shall we visit the stables while the rain holds off? There is still time to see Merriman's lovely new foal if we hurry. As the two ladies threw on cloaks and bonnets, a dark-clothed woman approached. She moved silently, fluidly, as though hovering.
"I wonder if I might ask you something, Your Ladyship," said.
"Could it wait, Miss Hartley? We were on our way to the stables."
"Of course," said Miss Hartley, inclining her head and moving away so smoothly that she was gone before the sound of her mistress's words faded.
"Did Miss Hartley need something?" Louisa asked, as they stepped outside and took the stairs that curved towards the garden.
"It will be Mary Ann and the party again. My daughter is developing all sorts of unsuitable ideas. May she lengthen her dress. May she wear her hair up. And she sends poor Hartley running to me every 5 minutes with her request. Or Miss Hartley sends herself. It is trying, frankly, when there is such an important occasion to prepare for."
"Poor Hartley," Louisa said, following her friend down the winding stone steps. "A governess is always betwixt and between. Perhaps she is hoping for a chaperone's invitation for herself."
They had reached the path in front of the house, heading for the stable block. Lady Felicity stopped abruptly and looked round at her friend. "The thought never entered my head. Hartley has never dined with the family on formal occasions.
The children are growing. Hartley will soon have no Pemberton children left to educate. She may see it as her last chance to attend a gala occasion here at the Hall. And she is musical. She began the children's musical education, did she not? She would surely enjoy the concert."
"Perhaps she would." Lady Pemberton turned and strode away. "But I have far more important matters to consider than a nervy governess's delusions of grandeur."
Chapter 10. Vito walked back to the far corner of the library near the tall windows, and pulling a volume of anatomy from the shelf, settled at one of the smaller tables and began to examine the contents. Page after page of intricate illustrations of the complex layers of equine muscle, skin, and bone. She was so absorbed that she jumped when she saw a figure had entered and was examining the shelves at the other end of the library. The lady wore a brown dress. Indeed, with dark hair and shawl, she seemed sombre from head to toe. She looked pale, Vita noticed,
and her arm, as it stretched to reach a high shelf, was thin enough for the sleeve to slide up at the wrist. Vita had a vague sensation of having seen her before. She watched as the lady, standing on tiptoe, first hunted hurriedly for something almost beyond her grasp, then located what she was seeking and lifted down a small blue bottle. She looked relieved. Vita felt that she ought at this moment to make her presence known. Not to do so would be rude. But she hesitated to interrupt the brown lady's anxious activity, settling for clearing her throat to show that she was there. This made the other lady start. In her shock, she dropped several coins, which must have been in her other hand. They rolled in all directions, and she stooped to gather them in jerky movements. Vita came across to help, but the coins were already retrieved. As she stood up, the lady in brown seemed deliberately to change her expression from one of flustered anxiety to something more composed. "We have not been introduced. I am the children's governess, Ada Hartley," she said, and held out a lace-gloved hand. "You must be Mrs. Brocklehurst's niece, Vita. I heard you were to join us. The children are eager to meet you." Her words were proper and welcoming, but Vita found Miss Hartley's hand cold and soft. It was a memorably unpleasant handshake. "I'm looking forward to meeting the children. Will they join the party at luncheon? Or perhaps I could visit them in the nursery," Vita said. This idea did not seem to appeal to Miss Hartley in the least. "They will eat luncheon with their cousins. Mary Ann will be attending the concert and dining with the guests this evening. It is her first adult dinner party, and she is quite beside herself with excitement, as you can imagine." Vita couldn't really imagine being overexcited at the thought of a dinner party, but she smiled as if she could. It was only several minutes after the governess had left that Vita saw a silver sixpence on the rug where Miss Hartley must have dropped it. Vita picked it from the floor and put it in her pocket, thinking she would return it to the governess in person. She had barely caught her breath before the doors opened again and an elegantly dressed young woman slipped into the library. She remained just inside, peering out into the corridor with her back to Vita, then danced lightly into the room, seeming delighted. It was only then that she saw that she was not alone. "Oh, someone is here," she cried in German. "Pardon me," Vita replied in the same language. "I was just exploring the library." The girl stepped forward. "You are one of the guests, I imagine. I am Carlotta von Diepenthal. Vita Carew, delighted to meet you. I've heard a great deal." At this point, an elegant young man came quickly into the library, looking back out of the door behind him, before turning with a look of delight to Carlotta. "Ah, Lottie, at last, I couldn't escape." His expression changed to one of surprise, perhaps even disappointment, when he saw that she was already in conversation with Vita. "We were just introducing ourselves, Alexander." The young man recovered his manners immediately. "So I see." He stepped forward and shook hands with Vita himself. "You must be Mrs. Brocklehurst's niece, Vita, isn't it?" "Your aunt is a great artist, I believe," Lottie said. "She is certainly kept busy with her commissions," Vita agreed. "I should so love to have my portrait made by her," Lottie said. "I think somehow a lady painter would have a particularly delicate touch, don't you think, Alexander?" Alexander smiled indulgently at Lottie, but spoke to Vita. "I heard that you are studying, Vita. Perhaps we are keeping you from your books." He looked towards the desk where Vita had been reading. "I was just exploring the library," she told him. The pair, standing closely side by side, both smiled kindly. But suddenly, Vita felt again that it would be better if she left. "I must see whether my aunt needs me, if you'll excuse me now." "We are not driving you out, I hope," Alexander said, still smiling. "Not at all. I am expected." Vita gathered her book. Reaching the door, she heard Alexander say something quietly in German to Carlotta. He had already stepped closer to her. "Vita speaks German, sweetheart," she heard Lottie reply quietly. It was, Vita thought as she climbed the stairs, an unchaperoned moment that she had interrupted. The quiet library, not quiet for very long, a maid was already approaching to light the fire, probably offered a rare opportunity for them to speak alone. At least one other person, a younger sibling or an older lady, would always be present at meetings of a single lady and a gentleman. Propriety demanded it. Vita was old enough to have heard friends bemoan the inescapable chaperone. She might have felt embarrassed, but she was still turning over in her mind the odd encounter with Miss Hartley. She looked at the book in her hand and saw she had carried Venner's Studies in the Anatomy of the Horse away with her. Unexpected bedtime reading, but oh well, the anatomy of the horse it would have to be. She would take it to her bedroom, she thought, only then realizing that she did not know how to find the yellow bedroom. Chapter 11. The brisk figure of the housemaid led Vita up a wide staircase and across a landing which led onto a long hall hung with family portraits. Rain was falling once more outside the tall windows. As they approached the far end, a small group of children ran in, and two boys began playing hide-and-seek, twisting themselves into the long curtains and crawling under sofas. Two older girls sat on one of the sofas, distancing themselves from the boys. The girls came over when they saw Vita. "You must be Vita," the younger of the two girls said. "I am Marianne. This is my cousin Virginia. These are our brothers. William is the one under the curtain. Oliver is under the sofa." The boys, now curious, extracted themselves from their hiding places and came over. They shook hands politely with Vita. "Where are you going?" William asked the maid. "I'm showing Miss Carew to the yellow room, Master William. She seemed eager to keep moving. I am interrupting her duties," Vita thought. "We can show her, can't we, Oliver?" William said. He took Vita's hand so as to guide her. "The yellow room is near the nursery." Vita was happy to agree. The figure of the maid swiftly receded, leaving her to the attentions of the two little boys. The girls had already settled themselves back on the sofa, deep in conversation. She was led away up a further wooden staircase and through another door. "It is quite easy to become lost in this house," Oliver told her as they walked. "I never get lost," said William. "This way, Miss Carew." "You live here, of course you don't get lost," said his cousin. "To visitors, it is very complicated. There are so many staircases. My father says it is because of the fires." "The fires were a long time ago," William said, opening a large door which led to another long passageway. "Yes, but they changed the building after the fires," his cousin insisted. "It was to make it safer, but it also made it more complicated." They passed a full suit of armour standing to attention, and for some reason the boys both saluted it. "That is the hero's armour," William said. "We always salute when we pass. You can too, if you like. It brings good luck." Vita rose to the challenge and gave the suit of armour her own formal salute. This won the boys' approval. Along the chilly corridor they went, then across another landing and into another passageway. Here the walls were bare of paintings, and there was a definite smell of damp. The corridor would have led off into the distance, but was blocked only a few feet beyond the first door by a very large mahogany tallboy placed across it. "Here we are. This is your room," William told Vita. He opened the first door on the left, and both the boys ran into the yellow room. They ran to the windows and looked out at the rain. "Thank you for bringing me here, William and Oliver," Vita said. "I am only worried now that I won't be able to find my way back." William came over. It's very easy, really. There are four main staircases, and this room is off the fourth one. It's the one with the monkey picture at the foot of the stairs, Oliver added. That's how I always remember. The schoolroom and nursery are just above here, William said. Look, I'll show you the staircase. It's hidden. They led her back out of her room into the broad corridor. On the wall opposite the yellow room, a very inconspicuous door was cut into the panelling. Only when you knew it was there could you see a small handle. William opened it and pointed up a flight of narrow, twisting stairs. These are the servant stairs, really, but they're quicker. My room and Mary Ann's are up there. Shall we go up, Ollie? I can show you my new soldiers. After a hurried but polite goodbye, the boys ran off up the stairs. Vita could still hear their voices above as she retreated to the yellow room and looked around. It was a grand room, and very cold despite having two large, ornate fireplaces. The curtains and wallpaper were all in yellow and gold, but even in the middle of the day, the light was dim. There was a tang of mildew in the air. It was certainly an example of the finest decoration of an earlier century, lavishly decorated from carpet to painted ceiling. But Vita did not find her bedroom at Pemberton Hall particularly welcoming. Her clothing and books had been unpacked by maids, so she found her nightdress, looking familiar but completely out of place, on the pillow of the overpoweringly draped and magnificent bed. So sumptuously canopied, so trimmed, flounced, gathered, embroidered, gilded, and worked with emblems and coats of arms was this bed, that it seemed exactly the kind of bed Napoleon, or indeed the Sun King himself, might have felt at home in. It's